This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Con Simos and Mango Parker from the Australian Wine Research Institute in South Australia. Is it Adelaide you guys are based?
That's correct, Chris. It's Adelaide, South Australia. So thank you for the opportunity to have a chat with you today.
Excellent, excellent. And Con, you work for the Australian Wine Research Institute, sort of almost interfacing with winemakers and...
Yes, that's correct. So my background is in winemaking. So when I came into the organisation, I was really here to provide that input to winemakers and actually talk to them and be able to understand their issues.
Yeah. And Mango, I understand you've got a PhD in chemistry, but Bachelor of Science and a PhD in chemistry. And your research is on, what's it called, glycosides? Is that the right terminology?
Yeah, that's right. I've got a PhD in wine flavour chemistry, particularly concentrating on glycosides and the flavour that they can give when you put them in your mouth. And that's relevant to smoke taint, which is my current area of research.
Yeah, and smoke taint's what we're going to talk about today, because it seems to me, and I've been in the wine trade now for about 20 years, and when I first joined the wine trade, smoke taint didn't really seem to be a big problem. But over the years, it's got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And we'll talk about that. But before we get into it, I think this is the first time I've actually interviewed anybody from the Australian Wine Research Institute. So, Con, do you want to tell us a little bit about the Institute and what you do and what your objectives are?
Yes, of course, Chris. So the Australian Wine Research Institute, we are an industry that's owned and funded by the Australian wine sector. So our structure is quite unique when you talk about what's the organisations which exist around the world. We are a non-profit organisation. So the organisation was set up over 60 years ago now, and it was primarily set up to solve industry problems. And so the ability to dive in when industry has a problem and to provide answers is pretty much part of our DNA. Now, the research component is a very, very important part of that. And that's obviously our principal business. But over a long period of time, what we have done as an organization is that we provide a whole lot of services and capabilities addressed to helping grape growers, Australian grape growers and winemakers tackle some of the challenges which they have.
And how's your funding? Is it all paid for by the Australian government, or how does it work?
The funding is actually quite unique. It's what we're funded primarily. It's not the only source of funding, but it's what we call through a levy system. So grape growers and wine producers, for every ton of grapes that's produced that's directed towards winemaking, there is a levy attached to that. And the federal government, so the Department of Agriculture in Australia, what they do is that they collect that money, and then the federal government matches that money, and then it comes back down to the industry to decide how they want that money invested. So primarily it is for research and development, and because that's our key capability, the organisation provides a lot of the support and the research designed to help industry tackle some of those issues and also find out more information.
Okay. And I suppose smoke taint's quite important because, as I was saying earlier, I never really heard about smoke taint as an issue until probably 10, 15 years ago. And all of a sudden, everybody seems to be quite worried about smoke taint. And it seems to be a problem that affects Australia, but you talk about California as well. I've heard of issues in Chile and South Africa as well. What sort of countries have problems with smoke taint? Because you don't hear of problems in Germany with smoke taint.
Let's go back a few years. So up until 2003, the organisation, I should say, insofar as producers were concerned, smoke taint did not come up on their radar at all. So this is a very, very new phenomenon. And it's really about what is happening globally. And we are in the middle of a changing climate, and that climate is warmer and it's becoming drier, and therefore those conditions are creating more and more fires or opportunities for fires to exist and also to be more intense. So it is a global challenge. I guess Australia, because of our technical expertise, And because of the fires which happened primarily in 2003, that's when research pretty much kicked off. And you know what we're seeing now is that, I mean, fires have always existed, whether it's in Europe or in California or anywhere else in the world. So everybody's in the same position. It's just that as an industry, we were probably a little bit more sensitive to it from the beginning. And, you know, we now, because of at least having 15, 16 years of knowledge, you know, we can impart that knowledge to also to other countries as well. And we're getting a lot of inquiries from the Californians, from the Europeans, how we manage this issue, what this issue is all about, what the priority is around this. So it's a global challenge, and we're all in the same planet, and it's all going to impact us sooner or later in one way or another.
Do you think smoke taint is a function of global warming? Because global warming means that bushfires are more, well, people talk about bushfires being more prevalent, but then you look at California's fires and some of the issues there are because people are just moving into the bush effectively where the fires that were, and in the past it would just burn off and no, never really affected anybody. But now if you're living in the bush or in the forests or in that scrubland in between, then you're going to be more affected by it. So there's going to be more media coverage. Is bushfire actually a growing thing, or is it just something that's become more prevalent recently because of changes?
It's become more prevalent because we, as I said earlier, because we are living in a warming, changing climate, and it's a dry climate. And therefore, we're going to see more fires. And it's irrespective of whether people are moving towards forests or to more native areas. You know, it's part of the, I guess it's part of the cycle which we now find ourselves in.
Okay, so I must admit, I find it hard to taste smoke taint in wines. I look for it occasionally, but I'm never quite sure what I'm looking for in smoke taint. Mango, what are the sort of key attributes that you might taste or look for in a wine that's got smoke taint?
Well, it can vary quite a bit, actually. How the issue first arose in the industry was that people commented about a lingering retronasal ash character. And besides that, the wines can be smoky, they can be a bit medicinal, they can be a bit meaty. Some of those characters in themselves are not too unpleasant, but the lingering retronasal ash character was the thing that the winemakers came to us and said, we really don't like it. It's not like the kind of smoky characters we see in oak. We particularly don't want those characters in some of our finer styles, sparklings, rosé, things like that. So it's a problem that we need to be able to address. But I would also say I hope you've never tasted a really badly smoke-tainted wine, because our winemakers here in Australia, they're very aware of the issue and they're really cautious. We've got excellent analysis now so that winemakers can have their grapes and their wine tested, and they really know what they're looking for and trying really hard to make sure that wines like that don't enter the market.
Yeah, everybody talks about it, but as you say, I'm really not sure whether I've actually had a wine with smoke taint myself. So obviously something's working. You mentioned retronasal. That's the bit where you don't necessarily smell smoke taint on the nose. Well, you can, but it's not there. Usually it's when you put it in your mouth and the flavours go down your throat, up through the back, and then hit your olfactory lobe. So is smoke taint more of a problem in the mouth than when you're sniffing your wines?
That was really a big problem for the winemakers, especially at the start, because we couldn't measure that to start off with. That's what caused us to initially look for compounds beyond just guaiacol, because guaiacol is a very smoky compound. It's found in a lot of oaked wines in quite high concentration, and it can be quite pleasant, like smoked almonds, smoky bacon. Even some people describe it as vanilla. So that's quite nice, especially if you like those smoky flavours in your foods.
Mm-hmm.
So when we started out looking into smoke taint, that's all we had to measure was guaiacol. And we knew that that wasn't the thing that was causing that ashy taste. So what happened in 2009 is we started to look for more markers. So initially we looked for more volatile phenols. So we have a suite of them. There's about seven that we routinely analyze. So guaiacol and the cresols. And the cresols can also come from oak, but they tend to be more band-aid, fecal, medicinal, a bit more unpleasant.
Brettomyces, it sounds like Brettomyces with band-aid and medicinal.
Exactly, and it's actually quite hard to distinguish on the nose a bretty wine versus a smoky wine, especially if you think that they've had a bit of oak. There's a fair bit of overlap in those characters, I would say. But that still didn't explain that lingering, ashy aftertaste. So that's why we started looking for other markers. When the winemakers first came to us to explain the problems they were having with smoke taint, what they told us was that they would have wines that they knew the grapes had seen some smoke, but when they tested the guaiacol and other volatile phenols along the way, when the wine was young, they couldn't see any smoky characters. But maybe after Malo or after a bit of age, they started to notice these smoky characters emerging. So we started to look for precursors, things, molecules that could release those smoky characters over time. Mm. And my colleague Yoji Hayasaka, he did a couple of really great experiments to work out that what's actually happening with smoke taint in the vineyard is that the grapes are actually breathing in the volatile phenols. They're taking up those smoky smells from the smoke right inside the grape. You can't wash it off. It's going right into the grape. And as a response to that, they are actually metabolizing those and forming glycosides. And those turned out to be the precursors that we were looking for that explained why those smoky flavors were coming later on in the wines as they aged and released those.
When they metabolize the glycosides, is it glycosides that they metabolize or the smoky characteristics that get metabolized into glycosides?
That's right. So the volatile phenols get metabolized. The grape essentially adds sugars onto the volatile phenol. What that does is it means that it's too heavy to be volatile, so you can't smell a glycoside. It's just too heavy to float around in the air. It doesn't get into your nostrils. And we think that the grape's doing that in an effort to detoxify the volatile phenols. And over a season, the grapes can actually accumulate quite a lot of these glycosides, the smoke taint precursors. So we were measuring them thinking that they would just be precursors to explain the flavour that develops in the wine as the wine ages. And one day my colleague Yoji said to me, well, what do the glycosides taste like? And we decided to do a bit of a tasting, and it was really very interesting. We tasted a couple of glycosides just dissolved in water. And there were about eight of us sitting around the table, and all we could see in our glasses was this colourless liquid that just looked like water. When we smelt it, it smelt like nothing. But then when we put it in our mouth, this smoky flavour developed. I felt like I had smoke coming out of my ears. It was so strong. It was disgusting. We spat it out quick smart, but some of us noticed it still even 20 minutes later and the penny dropped and we thought, wow, there's something here. This must be where that ashy retronasal character's coming from. And since then we've confirmed that that's how it's perceived.
Yeah.
So the glycosides actually break apart. So the sugar molecule, which is bonded to the volatile phenol, that bond actually breaks in the mouth. It's enzymes that come from the bacteria in the saliva, in fact, that are doing that. So the volatile phenol is released in your mouth and then you perceive it with your olfactory system via the retronasal route.
Okay, that's quite interesting because usually when you think about flavours and wines, a lot of flavours are bound up with sugars, precursor flavours are bound up with sugar. So if you pop a Cabernet Sauvignon grape in your mouth, you don't normally go, oh, I've got blackcurrant and I've got this and I've got this. You don't really taste it. And it's the process of alcoholic fermentation that sort of breaks the bonds and allows those volatiles to suddenly, all of a sudden, smell blackcurrant in your Cabernet Sauvignon. But Sauvignon Blanc is one of these grape varieties where the enzymes in your mouth can break those bonds, a bit like this, isn't it? Quite often, if you pop a Sauvignon Blanc in your mouth, you can taste some of the flavors from Sauvignon Blanc in your mouth, whereas most other grape varieties, you don't get any flavors at all. So is that a sort of similar type of situation going on there?
Look, I'm not an expert in tasting grapes. So to me, they all just taste sweet.
Yeah.
But some people can taste all those nuances. So maybe I better not comment about that.
Okay.
But definitely those thiol precursors can break down in the mouth as well. So in a Sauvignon Blanc wine, that could be the reason why some of them just have that amazing flavour persistence,
yeah,
with the precursors contributing to that long flavour and the aftertaste.
You're saying earlier that some of the problems associated with smoke taint were associated with ageing the wines and malolactic, and, you know, the wine may not necessarily taste a smoke taint when the wine's been finished, say, fermentating, but further down the track, it can develop smoke taint. I would have thought if a wine's undergone alcoholic fermentation and it's been made dry, then all those bonds between the sugar and the phenols would have been broken, so it wouldn't really reappear further down the track. So what's have I missed something there?
Well, the glycosides are fairly stable in the wine, but what we do see is that the concentrations of the glycosides can be way higher than the concentrations of the volatile phenols that we see. So if you have 100 times the concentration of glycosides, it doesn't take much of a breakdown of glycosides to be making an impact on the aroma. But I guess that's still a little bit unknown, because we've never really monitored a lot of wines over time to see how they evolve. So that's something that we're looking into still.
Okay.
Chris, can I just add, the way I would look at smoke taint, I would look at it as an iceberg. And it's a bit of a strange analogy, but stick with me. An iceberg is actually quite large. There's only a very, what is it, one-ninth or one-tenth of the actual iceberg sits above the waterline. And this is what we call the volatile phenols that you can actually smell when you have a glass and you're waving a glass in front of your nose. Invariably, what happens is that below the waterline, you have this very, very large piece of ice, which is what Mango was talking about, was that glycosidically bound fraction. And as an iceberg melts, it slowly releases the volatile phenols. As the water warms up and the iceberg gets smaller and smaller, it releases more and more of those volatile phenols. And so you've got two very, very distinct levels of chemistry, two very, very complicated levels of chemistry. And all of this is happening during fermentation, during primary fermentation, alcoholic fermentation, during malolactic fermentation, at a very fast rate, but that rate slows down, but it still continues as the wine is ages.
Yeah, okay. So you've got to be a bit careful about thinking, oh, I've solved my smoke taint problem with these grapes, because it'll come back and haunt you later on if you're not careful.
Exactly, yes.
What is the time frame for that? Because we all have different threshold perceptions. So a winemaker might have a very high threshold perception, go, oh, my wine's clean as a whistle, not a problem, bottle it up, and then 6 months down the track, someone with a lower threshold perception is going, oh, man, this tastes terrible.
Yeah, well, look, when we did that first tasting of the glycosides, when the penny dropped and we realised that they were actually contributing to the aftertaste, it was really interesting, because some people thought it was really strong and a couple of people didn't see anything at all.
Mm.
So everybody has their own sensitivity to things. I don't know if you like smoky flavours in your food. Some people love it and seek that out. Other people will sniff a peaty whiskey and just go, oh, that's disgusting, I don't want to put that in my mouth. So we're all different, and this is a really big challenge that we come across with smoke taint, and it's something that the winemakers in Australia are really aware of now. So we've got some very good rigorous sensory methodology, and they know not to just taste it themselves and come up with their own judgment, but to taste with a panel. And we've got some standards that we can send out so that people can test themselves and get an idea of how their sensitivity is to different compounds, and then take that into account when they're judging the wines. Because I think every winemaker is terrified of the possibility of putting a wine out there that looks fine to them, and to have somebody else come back and say, oh no, there's a problem with that. So yeah, we do a lot of tastings in panels to try and address that. And that's actually something that we've seen with consumers as well, that some consumers are really sensitive and they don't like any level of smoke in their wines. Others are moderately sensitive, and then there's another group that aren't particularly fussed by it. So I don't know if they're the people whose grandparents smoked pipes or what they're, how to explain those preferences, but there you have it.
So one of the early sensory trials that we did, and this was just with people from within the organisation. So these were experienced tasters. And so as one of our sensory scientists came up with a very basic test, and the test was to identify at what sensory threshold level these people could pick up guaiacol. And what that early work found was that there was a 1,000-fold difference between the very, very sensitive people to the people that were not anosmic, but were people that couldn't really identify guaiacol, the character that we were looking at. They couldn't see that at all. So it's a very, very wide difference. And that difference exists not just because you're an experienced taster, but it could be as part of the population. And so it's indicative of the, genetically, how we're wired, and we all have our sensitivities, and some people are sensitive to some compounds and, you know, not sensitive or even anosmic to other compounds. And this is really the beauty about wine when you talk about a wine. And if you have a great wine, you can have 25 people around the table and each person will have a different term how to describe that wine. And I think this is one of the sort of the key learnings of, you know, some of the fantastic work that we do at the Institute.
Okay. Just before we close up this interview, next week we're going to talk about some of the things winemakers can do. But smoky flavours in your wine can come from not just smoke taint, though. It comes from all sorts of places. So what are the common sources of smokiness that you might expect to get in a wine?
Yeah. So a lot of oaked wines can be a bit smoky. Mm. And that can be a really pleasant, deliberate thing that the winemaker introduces.
That's usually when they roast the inside of the barrel, isn't it? When you make an oak barrel, you normally toast the inside so you get a sort of smoky, toasty flavour.
That's right. And you can have barrels toasted to varying degrees. So a heavy level of toast will actually give you all the same kinds of volatile phenols that you see in smoke and that you see in smoke-tainted wines. But obviously that's a positive thing that the winemaker wants. But the winemaker can control that. So the winemaker can choose if it's a big flavoursome red, maybe that's appropriate to add a lot of oak and heavily charred oak for that style. What the winemakers don't really want is those kinds of characters coming into their very fine, beautiful, sparkling wines. Mm. And one of the main differences between the smoke-affected wines and oaky wines is that you don't get those glycosides, the smoky precursors, from toasting oak. So you don't get that lingering ashy flavour. That's really the big difference between smoke-affected wines and deliberately oaked wines.
Okay. I think we're going to wrap it up there, guys. Next week, I want to have a bit of a chat about if you do have a smoke incident in your vineyard, how you can deal with it, and is there anything you can do if you open a bottle of wine and you think it's too smoky yourself? So we'll have a chat about that next week. So thanks very much, guys. Thank you very much, Mango, and thank you very much, Con.
Thanks very much for having us, Chris. Such a pleasure to be on the show and showing off our Australian accents across the world.
Cheers, Chris. Thanks.